So 2 weeks ago then, we were looking at Hebrews chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. And we said that the theme of those verses is new revelation. New revelation. God having spoken, God having communicated in the past, has recently spoken again. That's what the writer is saying in those verses. God has delivered new revelation. That's the gist of them. And really then, everything in today's passage, from chapter 1 verse 5 through to chapter 2 verse 4, it continues to centre on that same theme. That may not be immediately obvious, but I hope you will increasingly, as we go on this morning, see that that is the case. This idea then, that God has delivered recently new revelation. God who spoke in the past has spoken again. That is the theme that everything here continues to centre on. And so having established that then, we have two headings this morning. First of all, the inferiority of angels. The inferiority of angels, verses 5 to 14 of chapter 1. Because that then is the specific point clearly being made in those verses. And of course it immediately raises some questions. Question number one, well, why focus on angels? Why does the writer spend all these verses focusing on angels? It seems a bit of a random topic. Well, the reason is this idea, which I mentioned 2 weeks ago, this idea that existed in the first century, that angels were one of the channels of God's past revelation. So you remember, this crops up a couple of times in the New Testament. Stephen refers to this in that great speech of his where he's been hauled before the Sanhedrin in Acts chapter 7, and he's defending himself, or rather defending his gospel, defending his message there. And in that context, in Acts chapter 7 verse 53, he refers to the law delivered by angels. And similarly, Paul, in Galatians 3:19, he talks about the law being put in place through angels. So there's clearly this idea that existed in the first century that angels were one of the channels of God's past revelation, specifically the law of Moses. The law of Moses had been in some way transmitted through angels. And angels then feature here in Hebrews 1 in that capacity. That's why the writer is focusing on them. He's focusing on them as this channel of God's past revelation. So that's one question, why focus on angels? But then the second question that immediately strikes us is, well, to what then are angels inferior? Clearly, he's demonstrating in these verses the inferiority of angels. Well, to what are angels inferior? Well, simply this, they are inferior to the channel of God's new revelation. So this new revelation that the writer is saying God has now spoken, it hasn't come through angels. It's come through a different medium, a medium that's even more distinguished, even more noble, even more sublime than the angelic medium that God formerly used. When placed alongside the channel of this new revelation, angels are found to be inferior. That's the point. So I'm saying then that verses 5 to 14 are setting out the inferiority of angels. And the writer does that then by this string of Old Testament quotations, which you can see quite clearly set out on the page of your Bible there. And through these quotations then, he spells out various ways in which the angels are inferior to their counterpart, the medium, the channel of God's new revelation. So let's just look at some of these ways. So first of all, notice the relationship angels lack. The relationship angels lack. So look at verse 5. For to which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son, today I have begotten you"? Or again, "I will be to him a father, and he shall be to me a son"? So the writer's asking a question there. And clearly the answer to the question is to none of the angels. To none of the angels did God ever say words like these. And I think the emphasis here is on the word "say". To which of the angels did God ever say, "You are my son", etc.? Because actually, interestingly, there are a few places in the Old Testament where angels are referred to as God's sons. There are one or two texts like that, in Psalms and in Job. But then I suppose that shouldn't surprise us too much, because equally, there's at least one text in the Bible which describes human beings generally, not just Christians, human beings generally, as God's sons. Acts 17:28. We are God's offspring, Paul says. But of course, Paul, when he says that about human beings generally, that human beings are God's sons, are God's children, are God's offspring, he means it in a very limited way, doesn't he? He's addressing there those Athenian idol worshippers. And he's trying to get across to them then that the real God is not an inanimate object, like all the inanimate objects in their shrines and their temples. And the line of argument then he's pursuing goes something like this. Look, God made us. And in that sense, then, we are kind of his offspring. And it's a basic principle that offspring resemble their parents. Kittens look like cats. Puppies look like dogs. Foals look like horses. And if we are God's offspring, then, we must, to some degree, resemble God. And if we are animate beings, if we are living beings, then God cannot be a block of stone. If we're his offspring, we must resemble him to some degree, and so he must be animate. He cannot be an inanimate object. So that's what Paul is doing. And so his reference then to human beings generally being God's sons, I'm saying, it's very limited in its scope. And similarly, those references you get in the Old Testament to angels being God's sons, they too are very limited in their scope. They're merely saying that in a certain sense, from a certain perspective, angels are kind of God's sons. Whereas what this verse is talking about, Hebrews 1:5, is a different thing altogether. It's not talking about someone who, in a certain sense, from a certain perspective, is kind of God's son. It's not talking about someone who, in some context, for the sake of argument, can loosely be called God's son. No, it's talking about someone whom God actually addresses in these terms: "You are my son." He doesn't talk like that to any of the angels. That's the point. They don't have that sort of relationship with him. Gabriel doesn't. Michael doesn't. The highest ranking member of the angelic community doesn't. They all lack that relationship with God that we encounter here in Hebrews 1 verse 5. So who does have that relationship with God? The writer isn't making up these words. These aren't merely hypothetical. He's quoting here. So God does speak to someone like this. To whom does God speak like this? Well, the answer is to the medium of this new revelation. God speaks like this. Remember verse 2. In these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son. the one through whom God has recently spoken, the one through whom God has communicated this new revelation, he is someone whom God addresses in the terms we find in verse 5, in this paternally intimate way, "You are my son." Because this person is God's son, really and truly and unreservedly. Full-blown divine sonship is his. He's not just God's son in some nominal, analogous sense, like angels, but truly, in the fullest sense of the term, he is God's son. And so that's the first aspect, then, of the angel's inferiority, the relationship angels lack. They are not truly God's sons. God never speaks to them and addresses them as his own sons. The relationship angels lack, but then notice, secondly, the requirement angels obey. The requirement angels obey. Verse 6, it says, "And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, 'Let all God's angels worship him.'" So God then makes a requirement of angels. There's a duty which God imposes on angels, this says. There's something he demands that angels do. What? Well, they must worship. That's the requirement that angels must obey. Now, supposing verse 6 simply said this. It simply said, "And again, he says, 'Let all God's angels worship.'" Imagine it just said that. "And again, he says, 'Let all God's angels worship.'" Now, that would still serve the writer's argument. It would then imply that angels must worship God, but this other person with whom angels are being contrasted, this medium of God's new revelation, because he's God's son, he doesn't worship God. And so that it would still teach the inferiority of angels. It would be saying then that angels are worshippers. The son, on the other hand, through whom God has now spoken, he is not a worshipper. He's above being a worshipper. And so that would be a perfectly appropriate point for the writer to make. But he goes further than that, doesn't he? He goes significantly further than that, because he says then, "And again, when he brings the firstborn into the world." Now, that's just another reference to the son. The firstborn is the son again. It's just a different title. "When he brings the firstborn into the world, he says, 'Let all God's angels worship him.'" See the significance of that? It's not merely that angels are required to worship, whereas the Son is not required to worship. Yes, that would indicate that angels are inferior. But it's more than that. The angels are required to worship the Son himself. That's the point. It's not merely that the Son is exempted from worship, whereas angels have to worship. It's that the Son is the very object of the angels' worship. That's how inferior the angels are. And so I'm saying then that this is a second aspect of the angels' inferiority here. The requirement angels obey. They're commanded to bow before the Son. The channels of God's past revelation are obligated to worship this channel of God's new revelation. That's the second aspect of their inferiority. But then a third aspect, the realm angels inhabit. So the relationship angels lack, the requirement angels obey, the realm angels inhabit. This is verses 7 to 12. And just in case then his readers are half asleep and they've managed to miss what the writer is doing, that he's drawing this contrast between the angels and the Son, this section makes that absolutely unmistakable, doesn't it? This section spells it out. Verse 7, "Of the angels," he says, dot, dot, dot. Verse 8, "But of the Son," he says, dot, dot, dot. There's no subtlety here. There's no ambiguity. He lays all his cards on the table. "I am drawing a contrast between the angels and the Son." the writer says. And what then precisely is the contrast in these verses? Well, look first at verse 7. Of the angels, he says, he makes his angels winds and his ministers a flame of fire. Now, I think the significance of the winds and the fire here is that they are basic elements of the created order. And the writer then is putting angels in that same category as wind and fire. Whether he's saying that angels are actually interchangeable with wind and fire, in other words, that sometimes they can appear in the form of wind and fire, he may be saying that, or whether he's simply making a comparison between angels and winds and fire, it doesn't really matter. The point is that angels on the one hand, wind and fire on the other hand, they don't exist on radically different planes. No, angels and wind and fire can be lumped together. They all inhabit the same realm. They all belong to the created order. That's his point. But then look at verses 8 to 12, where he moves on to the sun. And he has these two extensive quotations from the Psalms, from Psalm 45 and Psalm 102. But to get the main idea, you really just need to look at the beginning of the first quotation and at the end of the second quotation. So the beginning of the first quotation, he refers to the sun's eternity. His throne is forever and ever. And then at the end of the second quotation, he refers again to the sun's eternity. Verse 12, his years have no end. And you see then what he's doing. He's putting the sun in a quite separate category from angels. The sun doesn't belong to the created order. He belongs to eternity. That's the realm he inhabits. He does exist on a radically different plane from wind and fire and from angels as well. Of course, it's fleshed out, isn't it, in that second quotation from Psalm 102. Far from being part of the created order, we read in verse 10 that the Son is responsible for the created order. He laid the foundation of the earth. The heavens are the work of his hands. And then we see in verse 11 that he stands outside the laws of the created order, the law of entropy, that everything wears out, everything perishes. That applies, doesn't it, throughout the entire created order. It doesn't apply to him, though. He doesn't wear out like a garment. He doesn't perish. He remains, verse 11 says. And then in verse 12, the Son is the one who will finally undo the created order. Or perhaps it's hinted, will redo the created order. It will be changed like a garment by him. And you get the picture then. While angels are just another component of the created order, the Son, the one who has brought this new revelation, he isn't part of the created order. He's completely distinct. He's utterly unlike wind and fire that had a beginning and that are perishing and that one day will be wound up. None of that applies to him. He doesn't belong to that order. And so that's the third aspect then of the angels' inferiority, the realm angels inhabit. And then a fourth aspect of their inferiority, the role angels perform. The role angels perform, verses 13 and 14. Look first at verse 14, where the writer says, are they, that's angels, not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those to our inherit salvation? Now, let's just pause for a moment here and think about this word salvation. It's a word we often use, isn't it, as Christians? And I have a feeling, however, and I think Alan talked about this a few weeks ago in connection with Leviticus, I have a feeling that we often have a fairly narrow idea as Christians of salvation. What is salvation? Well, we say salvation is having Jesus living in my heart. And of course that's true. But that doesn't really do justice to the biblical dimensions of salvation. Or perhaps we say, well, salvation is being freed from my guilt, that guilt which would otherwise condemn me to hell. Salvation is being freed from that. And again, that's true and that's better. But still doesn't really do justice to the biblical dimensions of salvation. What then is salvation? Well, of course, one of the key chapters of the whole Bible is Genesis chapter 3. And Genesis chapter 3 then, that account of what happened in the Garden of Eden, it sets forth what went wrong at a very early point in the history of the world. And it sets forth then the great problem which in salvation is remedied. What? What is that great problem set forth there? Well, in short, it's this. A monstrous, vile enemy, Satan, invaded God's perfect creation, introducing sin and everything flowing from sin. That, in short, is what went wrong in Genesis 3. This monstrous enemy, Satan, invaded God's perfect creation, introducing sin and everything that flows from sin. That's the great problem. At the start of the Bible there, that everything that comes afterwards is addressing. And salvation, therefore, is ultimately the removal of Satan and everything that Satan introduced. By the way, that's why this verse, verse 14 here of chapter 1, as well as chapter 9, verse 28, and a couple of other texts in the New Testament, is why they present salvation as essentially a future reality. It talks about those who are to inherit salvation. Not those who already possess it, but those who are to inherit it. Because salvation is essentially something that will not be complete until the end, because salvation is the removal of Satan and everything that Satan introduced. Who are these inheritors then of salvation mentioned in this verse? Well, they of course are believers, God's people. From the fall in the Garden of Eden onwards to the end of history. And angels then are described in that verse as those who serve the inheritors of salvation. How do they serve the inheritors of salvation? Well, in different ways, of course, but in the context, the emphasis surely is on them bringing revelation from God. They are these messengers, this channel of God's revelation. That's how they served the inheritors of salvation. They mediated, they channeled that initial block of revelation about salvation. That's the role angels perform. What about the Son then? What role does he perform? Well, we know that he too mediates revelation from God about salvation. We've been saying that again and again. In his case, this new block of revelation that the writer is saying has recently come from God, it has come through him. He mediates revelation about salvation. So presumably then, at this point at least, angels and the Son are in the same category. They both serve the inheritors of salvation by bringing revelation from God about salvation. In the case of angels, that initial block of revelation, Sinai. In the case of the Son, this latest block of revelation. But look at verse 13. And here then, again, like in verse 5, we have something which God has never said to any angel. Sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. Never said that to any angel. To whom then has he said it? Well, he said it to the Son. And what does it mean? What do those words mean there in verse 13, that he has said to his Son? Well, basically, that is God saying to the Son, those enemies that ruined my creation, Satan and everything that Satan introduced, they are going to end up under your feet. That's what God is saying to the Son there in verse 13. Now remember, we said that's salvation, isn't it? That's salvation. Satan being removed and everything Satan introduced. And this verse is saying that it's going to be removed then through the Son conquering Satan. Through all those nasty things that came in the Garden of Eden, ending up under his feet. In other words, unlike angels, the Son then doesn't just bring, mediate, channel God's revelation about salvation. He does do that, but he also actually is the salvation. He is the conqueror of God's enemies. We talked about this last time, didn't we? That the Son is both the messenger and the message. He's the channel and he is the thing that is channeled. Angels are purely messengers. They purely convey through the law of Moses, which they mediated. They purely convey that one day there's going to be a conqueror. They don't do the conquering. The Son, on the other hand, he conveys the message and he actually is the conqueror. And so that's the fourth aspect of their inferiority, the role angels perform. And so I hope you can see then, we don't have time to go into the background to all these Old Testament texts, but I hope you can see they're all impressing upon us this reality, the inferiority of angels, the relationship angels lack. They're not God's sons. And the requirement angels obey, they worship God's Son. The realm angels inhabit, they are part of the created order, the Son isn't. And the role angels perform, angels are just messengers. The Son is the one who actually accomplishes salvation. And by the way, do just notice, we haven't got time to talk about it, but do just notice that we have in this passage one of that handful of New Testament texts, well, it's an Old Testament text, but it reappears here in the New Testament, that explicitly calls the Son God. As I've said sometimes before, if we had no texts that actually use the word God of the Son, we would still have more than enough evidence that the Son is God. But we do have a handful of texts that call the Son God. And verse 8, here is one of them, where the Son is addressed in these terms, your throne, O God, is forever and ever. So the inferiority of angels, but then very briefly as we close, the importance of acceptance. The importance of acceptance. And this is chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. What's the point of all this then? Why does it matter that angels, the channel of God's past revelation, are inferior to the Son, the channel of God's new revelation? Well, it matters because, as I said 2 weeks ago, these believers to whom this letter is being written, they are being tempted to go back to an Old Testament form of religion, a religion that ignores the coming of the Son of God and all that has happened through him. They're in danger of going back to a religion that's based just on the revelation that was channeled through angels. And the writer is saying, look, that is crazy. That is madness. There's been this new revelation, and its channel is greater than angels. Its channel is the Son of God. You must accept that. You can't ignore that and pretend it hasn't happened and just stick with the angels' revelation, because this revelation has come through a greater channel. Do not ignore it. You must accept it. And that's the acceptance I'm talking about then, the importance of acceptance. And just then, very quickly notice, first of all, we'll work through these verses backwards. First of all, no excuse. No excuse. This is second half of verse 3 and verse 4. And perhaps then there were some who were saying to these Christians, remember, these Christians are probably Jews, almost certainly Jews, converted to Christ, and perhaps some of their fellow Jews who weren't Christians, were saying to them, well, look, this whole business of the Son of God having come into the world, this whole business of the Son of God having come as the climax of God's revelation and having defeated Satan, well, is it really true? How do you know it's true? How can you be sure of that? Where are you getting that from? Sounds a bit implausible to us. And they were saying things like that. And that then perhaps was becoming an excuse, a pretext for some of these believers, as they were drifting back toward a religion based simply on the angel's revelation, Old Testament religion. Well, can we be sure that God has really spoken now through his Son? And that's why then the writer points out there at the end of this paragraph that there's no such excuse, because this revelation, it was declared at first, he says, by the Lord. So they're saying this revelation, it came indeed through the Son. He's simply saying that again there. But he says it was attested to us by those who heard. In other words, we got this from those who actually saw the Son. Those who actually knew the Son, person to person, those who spent time with the Son, those who saw him die on the cross, who saw his empty tomb and his risen body. It was attested to us by them. And then he mentions this additional strand of testimony, that God then, in those early days of the Christian churches, we saw this in Acts, didn't we, when we were working through that book, God's perform miracles. And this then was part of the attestation of the truth of the gospel that had come through the Son of God. And so the writer is saying that there are no excuse that, oh, we can't be sure about this. It's been attested to us by those who were eyewitnesses. And by the way, that argument still applies for us if we're ever tempted to doubt the truth of the gospel of the Son of God. It has been attested to us by those who first heard from the Lord, those who first encountered him. That's what the New Testament is, isn't it? It's the eyewitness, in many cases, testimony. This isn't a book that was written centuries later. These writers of the New Testament are those who were there, many of them, and are attesting to us what they saw and heard. So there are no excuse. There's no excuse of that kind for not accepting this revelation through the Son. No excuse. Secondly, no escape. This is verses 2 and the first half of verse 3. And it's fascinating then, the logic here, since the message declared by angels proved to be reliable and every transgression or disobedience received a just retribution, how shall we escape if we neglect such a great salvation? So he's saying then that the revelation through angels, if you didn't accept it, if you were an Israelite and you rebelled against it, then there was punishment. And he's saying, well, the same logic applies, but on a greater scale. That revelation now has come through the Son, and that's a greater revelation, through a greater channel. If you don't accept it, then it's not just that you're missing out, but there'll be inevitable punishment. You can't escape, he says. He doesn't say that, won't we miss out if we neglect such a great salvation? He says, how shall we escape if we neglect it? And you think, well, it's a strange parallel, because that makes sense with the law, that if you don't accept the law, if you rebel against it, you get punished. But with the gospel, you don't accept it, you rebel against it, you get punished. But that's what the writer says. And he emphasizes it later on in very, very strong terms in this letter, in chapter 10, verse 26 onwards. He says, if we go on sinning deliberately after receiving the knowledge of the truth, and he's meaning there then, if we reject having accepted the revelation through the Son, if we then reject it, there no longer remains a sacrifice, but fearful expectation of judgment and a fury of fire that will consume the adversaries. He's talking here to professing believers. And he continues, anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the evidence of two or three witnesses. How much worse punishment do you think will be deserved by the one who has spurned the Son of God and has profaned the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has outraged the Spirit of grace? It is a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. He's talking to professing believers. If you're someone this morning who has professed faith in the past, and today you are toying with another lifestyle altogether, please hear these very strong warnings. I'm not standing here saying, well, that's a shame if you do that because you're missing out on all the blessings. No, I'm standing here saying there's no escape if you do that. No escaping judgment. It's a fearful thing to accept the revelation through the Son and then reject the revelation through the Son. That's what the writer is saying. No excuse, no escape. But then thirdly, no easing off. No easing off. How does he envisage this happening? People who have accepted the revelation through the Son, accepted the gospel, then rejecting it subsequently. How does he envisage it happening? Them just kind of waking up one day and saying, nah, don't want this anymore. Now look at verse 1. We must pay much closer attention to what we have heard, lest we drift away from it. Drifting away. That's how he envisages it possibly happening. I've used before illustrations from one of my favourite pastimes, poo sticks, and the way in which then, you know, you drop your sticks into the river on one side of the bridge, and there's always one, isn't there, that fails to appear on the other side. And then you kind of notice that it's got stuck on the edge of some rock or something. And you watch for a while, and as the current kind of comes against it, it gradually kind of moves out from the rock, and then eventually it carries on. Of course, it's come last because it's taken so long. But eventually, the current pushes it on again. That's the kind of picture here. And he's envisaging these believers then. And yes, that they're still kind of functioning more or less as believers at the minute. But there are these currents of temptation, going back to temple worship and sacrifices, the revelation through angels. And he's not worried then that the first time they ever hear that temptation, they're just going to go. He's worried that over time, it's like that current keeps on flowing. They'll just drift and drift until they're gone and there's no escape. And of course, that temptation isn't our temptation. Going back to the revelation that came through angels. But still for us, perhaps, the way in which we are most likely to relinquish the gospel of Jesus Christ, if we're believers, is just through this gradual drifting process. Yes, Jude talks, doesn't he, about being kept from falling, and believers can just suddenly fall, and it does happen, but more often it's just this drifting away. And the writer fleshes this out later on in the letter, gives us examples of this. You think of chapter 10 again, and how he talks about some who have forsaken the gathering together of believers. Doesn't perhaps seem a huge deal just to start to ease off on attendance at the means of grace, but it's this drifting. He talks in chapter 13 about the love of money, which clearly has become another temptation to some of these believers. And again, it's just a gradual thing. Money becoming more and more of a goal in their lives. And that's then how it can happen. You think of chapter 12, and he talks about the sin that so easily entangles. Again, that picture isn't of a gradual process. Not sin just knocking you off the Christian road in a single blow, but gradually entangling you. Be careful of that. It means that it can happen with us barely noticing, which is why we need to stop ourselves sometimes, often, and say, where am I? How am I doing? Am I still accepting with wide open arms the revelation of God through his Son, the gospel? Or am I drifting? Let's check ourselves for that this morning. Amen.